This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9 and Sunday Arts Magazine with Brendan Michael Bale and David John Hunt. Hello, Brendan Michael Bale.
Hello, David John Hunt. How are you?
I'm extremely well today.
And have you had an arty week?
I've had a very arty week this week, yeah. Wonderful. What about you?
I have, actually. I fit a couple of films in as well.
Right.
So I've got onto those.
Okay.
It was touch and go there for a minute there, David. I had to sort of schedule my life around them. Cause one of them was, a film called Midnight Special that I've heard a bit about it. It's got a bit of a groundswell, going for it.
Yep.
A bit of an indie film, from, sort of an up and comer. He has been around for a while, but he's still sort of on the fringe, Jeff Nichols.
Right.
And it's actually written by him as well. And this film stars Michael Shannon, Joel Edgerton, the great Aussie actor.
Oh, right.
And director now. Yeah. He directed a film last year.
Now, I saw it being reviewed the other day.
Mm.
And so it's sci-fi.
It is sci-fi. Yeah.
Yep.
A bit of a throwback to sort of Starman, Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah.
Sort of that slow burn, sort of almost 70s feel.
Right.
Sci-fi rather than something like an Independence Day kind of film.
And it's getting pretty good reviews, Isn't it? But I believe it's only going to be in limited release.
Yeah, that was the issue. I just sort of had to hunt around for it in Melbourne. But strangely enough, it was at one of the multiplexes, but not all of them. So
I went
to one of the ones in South Yarra.
Right, okay.
So I found it and went. And I quite enjoyed it, but I suppose I had quite lofty expectations of the film.
Right.
I really liked his previous film, Mud, and I know he's very much an actor's director, and he pulls out these great performances from people like Michael Shannon, who he's worked with four times now. So I sort of had these really lofty expectations, as I said.
And you didn't get up there?
It was good.
Yep.
It was technically a really good film. It was a road movie, essentially, what's happening with the characters. And you sort of start out in the thick of the story. There's not much of a setup. You're sort of thrown into this room with these two male characters. So Michael Shannon and Joel Edgerton with this young boy, and you don't know, it's almost like an abduction film, so you're sort of thrown into that, and then you gradually get these little strands of knowledge sort of thrown at you quite subtly throughout the film.
Yep.
And you sort of piece together what's happening, and eventually by the time the boy's mother comes in, who's played by Kirsten Dunst, you start to get some answers, but it actually poses more questions than answers.
Do you know what? I actually quite like a film like that. That really challenges you, that you've actually got to work things out instead of, you know, hand feeding you. And I like that a lot, actually.
I agree with you with that. I would actually prefer a film like this compared to something that's sort of suited more to the mainstream audience. But I think Jeff keeps it a little bit too obtuse. You know, I was sort of going through it and I thought, well, there's not a lot that differentiates itself from the movies that I mentioned a little bit earlier. It was lacking something that would make it special, which I'm actually kind of going against the tide. A lot of the critics were sort of blown away by the way Nichols has presented this film, but I was just a little bit underwhelmed, unfortunately.
Okay.
But
right.
You know, it's a smart film.
Yeah.
And maybe I was just watching it the wrong time. I wanted a few more answers than questions posed, especially by the end. You know, it sort of crescendos to quite a poignant finale, but I just wish some of the strands were a bit more, a bit stronger throughout. So I can only give this one Now, I'm getting a little bit harsher, David. Brendan. I've heeded your advice. I'm going to get a little bit more
harsh. Controversial.
I'm going to give it 3 stars.
Okay.
So that's still a recommendation.
Yep.
But,
well, that's a good recommendation.
It is.
Three out of five.
It's middling, for reasons that the directing is really, it is really strong. The images put on show are really strong. I just had a little bit of an issue with, how didn't really resolve some of the strands that are put up. So, for example, one of the strands, you know, the boy was actually living in sort of a cult society and they sort of saw him as almost a messiah. And so you sort of have this this plot point that carries for at least a third of the film.
Yep.
And then it just sort of drops off. You've got the great Sam Shepard playing this sort of cult leader figure at the start. And he just drops out of the film straight away, and which is, I think, to its detriment. I think it could have balanced those narratives a little stronger.
All
so
right.
three stars. Another film I'm going to say straight out of the bat, it is a 3-star film. Porno. P-A-W-N-O, David, before you get any ideas in your head. This is a new film set in Footscray, my old stomping ground, 5 kilometres west of the city in Melbourne. And this one, it's I read a review in The Guardian. It was a little bit harsher than I felt about it. It's very much one of those films that the location is one of the characters, essentially, of the film.
But I love that.
Me too. So, you know, that familiarity that I had with the film, I probably liked it more because of that, because that felt quite authentic, very much tongue-in-cheek of what that area sort of was, is, and is becoming, because of the gentrification taking over rapidly in that part of the city.
Oh, absolutely. Changing, you know, like from, I moved here many years ago, and when I first moved here, it was very much still the Greek Italian population with Asian coming in, and then it went crazy into especially Vietnamese people, and now all of a sudden it's turned a corner again, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's gone full hipster, which, you know, it has its pros and its cons.
But what I like about, you know, like, we're not really talking about the film here, but if you said it's part of the character, but what I'm liking about that is that unfortunately a lot of the Asian restaurateurs and whatever didn't really care very much about the buildings they were in, and they were just decaying and falling to pieces, where a lot of people are now moving in and doing those beautiful facades up. So if that's got anything to do with the film, it...
Well, not particularly, but it is. It's part of that whole idea of what Footscray is. And it's kind of, you know, endemic of a lot of those little areas around, you know, scattered around Melbourne. You could say the same thing about what happened with Richmond and Fitzroy and Collingwood. You know, there's always going to be that struggle between, you know, what was and what is to become. And this film, you know, on the surface, it sort of does tap into that a little bit. The characters that it chooses, you've got a pawn shop owner and his employee. You've got a couple of employees from the bookshop down the road. And you've got these sort of, in the review, they're called homeless, a couple of homeless people, but I'm not sure if they're homeless. They're just sort of, you know, maybe on the fringe of society a little bit. But they're the most entertaining characters, I find. They're sort of to and fro, incredible sort of to and fro between those actors.
Right.
And that, the characters that are chosen, there's a trans character as well. So the characters that are chosen, I find, sort of tap into what, you know, where the direction of that area is going. So you've got the old school, you know, pawn shop that probably thrived in the 80s and 90s and now sort of coming up, like, you know, is that kind of a business going to survive in, you know, essentially what's going to be a yuppie paradise?
Well, but hold on there. You know, like, they are in respect. There's one big mainstream one now that advertises on television, but which I, you know, I can't say it. Well, I could say it, but I don't want to say it on air, but there is one that's huge. Now, and I know someone that's made a lot of money out of that particular brand, but it's not the little local pawn shop per se.
No, but it's funny you mentioned sort of the markups and stuff, because in one scene in particular, there's a guy that's trying to sell a camera, and the pawn shop owner sort of offers him sort of a lowball number, and eventually the guy takes and he says, "Oh, yep, put $1,000 on that." and would make a fortune on it.
And of course there is, on cable here in Australia, from America, the Pawn Shop.
Oh, I do love
series. So there you go.
There you go.
Yeah. So three
you could
stars.
Be right. You could be right. 3 stars from that one. If you've got any of a connection, any kind of a connection to, the West or Footscray in particular, I think you will get a lot more out of this one. It's a little bit scattershot, but the characters are quite strong. I really sort of identified with a number of them or could sort of appreciate them for what they were. Mm. A little bit caricature-ish, but I thought it was quite a decent film.
Okay.
And it's from a an actor-director. So we'll see how he goes. I've forgotten his name now, but we'll see how he goes going ahead.
Yep. In the future.
Yeah, but Kerry Armstrong, she plays a small role in the film.
Yep.
And and I say small, it is very small in the film, but she made me cry. So.
Oh, there's a
there
good
you
actress.
Go. Love Kerry Armstrong.
Now my little touch of the arts this week that I want to just quickly mention, because it has been covered by a lot of the major media. We're talking about the NGV again, because and we talk about them almost every week because so much is happening there. But I'm sure as the exhibitions come along, I'm talking about their spring summer collections for the end of this year into next year. And the big blockbuster is David Hockney, who I've always loved. His art is, and he's still going, you know, he's still kicking ass, and I believe he's coming, here to Australia for it. And John Olsen, who remember we actually had about the John Olsen frog,
yes.
6 months ago, which is a sculpture in the park across the road from the NGV. So there's, a John Olsen, collection as well, plus many others, but they're the two big ones in that respect coming along to the NGV.
Well, I'm very excited for the fashion part as well, Victor and Rolf.
Yes. Which are very much pieces of art.
They really are. You look at the images that were supplied with the press release.
Yep.
And they're sort of iconic, but they're also forward thinking.
Yep.
So I'm very excited to
and they're coming out as well. So, which will be really interesting because their last collection that they did, they actually, the catwalk was in a gallery.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I love that. And, before we move on, David, we've got a message in. Our messenger would love your thoughts or our thoughts on Prince as an iconoclast.
Oh gosh. Quite upset about it, actually. I saw him live, not this last time around. I saw him, the Diamonds and Pearls tour, which was spectacular. Mm. I know a lot of people that went to this. I couldn't afford it, you know, because it cost so much money. Yeah. The tickets were crazy prices, but they loved it. They thought it was really good. It was just him on stage with piano. Mm-hmm. We will be playing a Prince track a little bit later on. So yeah, and he was a true artist. The way he dressed as well, he was like an installation. You know, his whole look, the rest of the band around him, all the people that he had on stage with him, they became, it was a true art form. He really was a master and had a lot of, people are very upset about this one.
And it was fitting that the Art Centre, made their spire purple to celebrate and commemorate his passing.
Absolutely. Now, a guy that was around 400 years ago, did you know him?
Well,
then?
No, but were you friends with him?
I was. Okay. Yes, I hung out with the bard a fair bit. We are talking about Shakespeare as his 400th anniversary, and two really interesting things have happened that two very different artists are releasing, or one's released an album, the other one's next Friday. And this artist we're going to play now is Paul Kelly, and he has actually put music to 7 sonnets and poems. So this is one of them, which I think is wonderful. Next week we'll play Rufus Wainwright, who's done exactly the same thing. They've obviously picked different songs, well, different sonnets to put music to. But, you know, Paul Kelly is, he's one of our greatest storytellers now. He's legendary now. He really is a legend in Australia. And it's quite wonderful that he has done something like this. So here is his, and it's just called Sonnet, this one. And to celebrate, as part of the celebrations of Shakespeare's 400th year. You're on Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine.
When My love swears she's made of truth. I do believe her, though I know she lies.
Joy.
You're on Sunday Arts Magazine here on Joy 94.9 with David and I just looking at each other lovingly.
All of a sudden we thought, oh, who's going to say it? We didn't actually plan it.
Normally we're just fighting with each other for the airtime, but you know.
Yeah.
No jokes. But we have got another message in, David.
Okay.
A thank you, actually, for us talking about Prince before. He was the soundtrack of my life.
Aww.
Which, do you know what? I honestly didn't really get why people, or, you know, how much of an impact he had on people's lives until this happened. I've had a number of people come up and tell me that, you know, kind of very similar thing. He was the soundtrack to their lives, or, you know, they actually did affect their lives in some way.
A lot of people grew up with him.
Exactly.
I grew up with the Beatles, changed my life. Mm. And I was lucky enough to be part of the, you know, like the music industry and when Prince was around. And I was actually at a nightclub after his, one of his shows that he did many years ago when he was there. And it was when he was being a bit weird. I was all sectioned off and it was just him sitting there, no one else in this section, but he was watching people dance. That's what he was doing. You know, like.
I guess he was such an inspiration to people, but also was inspired by so many people as well, and had
that whole funk soul stuff that he did. Yeah.
So it is very sad with his passing, but you know, there's always that silver lining, which sort of says that a lot of people that hadn't experienced him before then come to him after. And the same thing happened with Bowie.
Yep.
You get that new generation coming through that can then appreciate it. You know, at least you've got that to fall back on.
Absolutely. Now talking about music, with our next our first guest for today, is connected with the music industry. Who is it?
It is Jack the Bear, inspirational speaker and all-around sweetheart, apparently. Oh, welcome to Joy 94.9.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. It's lovely to be here. And, David, lovely to see you after all these years. I mean, we're kind of like feeling each other out before, but it's been a while since I've seen you.
Yeah, give us a bit of your background, because we always like to do that with our guests.
Absolutely. I'll be delighted to. My background essentially started with being a DJ as a teenager, and I had a real love of just the making of records, and I worked out very early that I was not destined to be on stage. I didn't have the aesthetic, so I worked that out pretty quick. I said, okay, we'll go behind the scenes. So I loved music as a child. I collect a lot of records. So I did a lot of mobile DJing,
Who was your favourite artist? We were talking about Prince, who was influenced so many people growing up. Who was your generation?
Growing up, it was more the Zeppelin, the Stones.
So a little bit more rock?
A little more rock. But then I got into disco in a big way, which just did, you know, when I heard Chic Le Freak, that was like, oh, my God. Like, what have I been missing out on? You know, like, the guitars just don't have to be. So I loved disco, I loved funk, and so and then I even got into progressive jazz. I was one of those weird kids at school that wasn't necessarily into the mainstream. You know, I'd be getting off on my weather report and John LaPonte and Stanley Clark and Level 42 and all this kind of stuff. I always believe that there's only one style of music, and that's good. And of course, that's a very subjective thing. But for me, I think if music is honest and it's heartfelt, and when you hear it, you feel something straight away from it.
Right.
Then that, in my book, is quote unquote good.
Now, so many people, and it's a discussion Brendan and myself are going to have down the track, and I've got somebody, a powerhouse, coming in to talk about it, but she's overseas at present. Do you class popular music as an art form?
Oh, most definitely. I just because something is relatively new in the context of music and art, I'd hate to think what was Mozart and Beethoven considered back in the day?
Well, exactly.
You know,
but there was no such word as a pop star.
Yeah, but it was the mainstream of the time. You know, it was the music of the time, the expression, the reflection of the time of the people. So I think it's easy to be able to discount pop music as being frivolous and pointless and rubbish and whatever. But I think if art doesn't make you stop and think and it doesn't challenge you, then it is not doing its thing. And, you know, it's easy to be very flippant and to say this is rubbish and this is because it doesn't fit in with what you particularly like. But the beauty of art is that it's completely open to interpretation. And I think if you can come to it with an objective and open mind and just allow it to be for what it is, then you'll get so much more out of it, because I think it's the height of ignorance to just simply dismiss something straight away simply because it doesn't fit in with your taste.
Well, I find with visual arts, Andy Warhol, Ai Weiwei, who is the toast of the town right now, and it finishes today, and the queues, by all accounts, are huge, which everyone leaves it to the last minute, of course. But art, in that art world, as in visual arts, pop is part of art, where with music it wasn't looked at that, because all of a sudden it became too mainstream, and so therefore the art world sort of turned their back a little bit and go, oh no, it's not avant-garde, or it's not jazz, or it's not classical.
So. Yes, it doesn't fit in with the chin stroker scene, so to speak.
Yeah. So we'll come back. We're speaking to Jack the Bear, and we haven't finished with your history yet, but we're going to get to who you are and what you're doing right now, right after this. You're on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
You are on Joy 94.9. It's Sunday Arts Magazine with Brendan and David. And that was a track, you might know it, it's called Cream by Prince. We've had a little bit of a tribute to him. And we've had a message in from our lovely messenger today. Great thoughts on, well, something we had. Probably about Prince, I would assume. art soothes the mind, body, and the soul.
Yes.
Certainly does. And, yeah, unfortunately, that track was to commemorate the passing of Prince. So, and I'm sure a lot of tributes have been coming in this week about him as well.
Absolutely. Now, we've still got in the studio with us Jack the Bear. Now, we didn't get far. You all of a sudden started talking about music that you grew up with. So you ended up working at one of the commercial radio stations?
That came a little bit later. Once I finished high school, I just bummed around. I went overseas and I bummed around lots of different studios because I wanted to be an engineer. I wanted to do behind the scenes stuff. So I pretty much just lived out of a proverbial suitcase for 10 years. Just slept around different studios learning my craft, and I've found out about mastering, which is what I do, the final stage of when the bands record their material, they bring it to me as a stereo track, and then I'll optimize the sound to make it sound as best as I can, as finished as possible, so that it'll be ready for CD manufacture or vinyl manufacture these days. So it's the final step of the
creative. It's not an engineer, and you're not a producer.
I'm not a producer, and I'm not a record engineer. I'm an engineer, but I just do mastering, which is its own discipline from, say, a recording engineer or a mixing engineer. So very different disciplines.
Yeah. Which a lot of people just get so confused with all those different processes that go through when you're recording, but it gets rid of all the hissy sounds and the clarity of it.
Yeah, the sound, and the sound is balanced, and the dynamic integrity of the songs are there. And again, it's the best way I would be defining it is I'm framing a picture. So an artist paints a picture, and I will frame it and put it in to present it in the best possible light.
Okay.
So
a beautiful way of putting it. Okay, so you're an engineer now?
Yes, I still have my business called Deluxe Mastering, which is in Brunswick. But the main thing I've been really working on recently is in my inspirational speaking, which is primarily looking towards talking to artistic and creative kids, because as a guy who struggled wanting to be to work in the artistic creative domain and having a lot of resistance from a very young age because academia it was all about academia. Through my experience now, I just want to share it with these young kids and go out there and tell them that, you know what, being an artist is valid, it's relevant, it's a beautiful thing, and you know, it's art makes the world go round, and you should be very proud of yourselves to call yourselves artists, and that you should be pursuing it with great gusto.
Because these days it's very, very hard, because the whole world is getting smaller in that artistic arena, isn't it? And especially with the recording and engineering and producers and whatever on, because so many people are doing it from a bedroom now, aren't they?
They are. It's certainly, over the last 20 years, 15, 20 years, the industry certainly has become a much more cottage industry, but I think it's a very healthy thing. I think it's wonderful that a kid these days, I mean, 1981 where I started, there was no internet. There was no software. It was very difficult to get information or to be in touch with anyone for mentoring. Whereas now, I think it's wonderful that a kid now with a nominal amount of money can go out and buy some great technology, some great software, and they can roll their sleeves up and they can get creative and they can start making music and getting involved that way.
But it's also really important to have somebody like yourself with the knowledge that you can pass on to them.
Oh, absolutely. And I think as, you know, I turn 53 in June and I'm going through a bit of a reinvention myself, and I feel, you know what, I've got 30 odd years of experience doing this, and I've made my fair share of mistakes, and I understand what, you know, the fear and the anxiety of wanting to do something that's artistic or creative. So now it's about just putting the message out to these kids and saying, you know what, I get it. I've been there. But more importantly, it goes deeper than that. I'm a great believer in the reason why many of us never reach our full potential, and it may be art, maybe music, could be anything, but ultimately it comes down to our primary fear that we are not enough. Mm. So, you know, it's about talking to these kids about their self-esteem and challenging them to look at that and say, you know what, you kids are worthy. You kids need to be – happiness is your birthright, plain and simple. So, you know, I get it. I know what it's like, but I've done it, and this is how I did it. So if I can do it, nothing's stopping you.
And is that the reason you sort of picked up on that and wanted to share that with people, because you felt that need was there?
Absolutely. And I think even in a lot of mainstream, I get to do a lecture at a lot of the, you know, mainstream universities, and they do a fantastic job. And it's great that there are options now for kids to go and learn about these things, because those things weren't available back when I started. But what I found through my talking to the kids is that I used to go into these colleges to talk about specifically mastering. What I'd find, though, out of 10 kids, 2 may be interested, really interested, but the other 8 weren't all that interested, and that's fine. What the other 80% were really interested in is what, okay, how do I make a living out of this? Like, okay, I've got all this theory, I've got a great qualification, but what do I do with it? Like, how do I take the first step to going out there in the real world, setting myself up, and making this thing happen?
Also, you keep on saying kids, because primarily they're the sort of people that are going to come to you. But we're finding more and more the people we speak to in the visual arts that a lot of them are actually older people now, because they had to work on their you know, career in finance or whatever it was, or a lot of women they married and had children and couldn't follow their dreams. Mm-hmm. So therefore, when families have grown up and all of a sudden you're in this sort of place now where you can afford to follow your dream, I reckon that there's probably a lot of middle-aged people that would be very interested in talking to you.
Oh, look, definitely, because, again, having had my own, you know, midlife crisis and all that kind of stuff as well. Look, definitely. I guess the reason I'm aiming more at kids is because I work in an industry where I see kids in and out every day. And so, and I'm amazed just how open these kids are to me. They talk about, you know, deep and dark stuff, man. But I think, you know what? What a privilege that is, man, that these kids are prepared to trust you to talk about their stuff, and you're able to offer them something too, and from a place of empathy and from a place of authenticity.
Now, you do master classes, you said, and then also one-on-one situations?
I do mentoring to kids, I do group sessions, and all that work I've been doing has been all volunteer work. And that's just my way of giving back, because you know what? I'm so fortunate and so blessed that I have been able to make a living doing what I love doing. And it's been an absolute privilege. And so, you know, I'm in a position now where I can give back in terms of my experience and share my story and hopefully inspire people, because we all have those pivotal moments in our life when we meet someone and they just say that one thing that sets you off on a different trajectory for the better. And you'll never know what that is and where it's going to end up, but I've got opportunities to do that.
How do people get in contact with you? Do you have a website?
I do. It is positivelyspeaking.com.au.
Great name. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And the email is mastering@jackthebear.com.au.
So just give us the name of the website again, because that's where a lot of people will go, because it's easier to find.
Sure. Positivelyspeaking.com.au.
Thanks so much for coming in today.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks very much, Phil. It's great to see you.
You're on Joy 94.9.
Joy.
You are listening to Sunday Arts Magazine here on Joy 94.9. And that was Chelsea Wilson.
Yes.
I hope that you're unhappy.
Mm.
I love that song. It's a great breakup song.
A damn good song. She is, we actually have had her on our show. It was last year now. Gosh, time flies, doesn't it? And she is a soul singer. But what I love about her is that she has a collective of other women and women of soul. They do, and that's all different. She pulls them together, and it's all soul singers that she finds out and around on the circuit, and puts these shows on. And they're now playing quite a few festivals because at some shows I went to one last year, and there was seven of the women on stage, and they're all very different. Their soul music is very different, because that's the wonderful thing about soul music. But she played one of the smaller stages at Glastonbury Festival last year as well, and then went on to London, and she was invited to go to Glastonbury as well. So for a local a Melbourne girl, done good.
Really
Jack
good.
The Bear, who does all the mentoring and whatever, I used to do it a little bit with one of the private colleges, the music private colleges, and she was in my first year class.
Well,
the first year that I taught.
No wonder she did really well.
Exactly. How could she not? And she's also very heavily involved in PBS as well. She has a soul show on PBS.
Another great community radio station in Melbourne. And now speaking of Jack the Bear, aka Tony, we got a message in from Steve from Castle, Maine. Actually, am I saying that right? Is it Castlemaine or Castlemaine?
Well, it depends
on
where.
Got brought up on it.
Yeah, it depends on. See, I would say Castlemaine.
Let's go Castlemaine. Good to hear you're still around, which is nice.
Yeah, and we passed that on to him. We saw the message just when he was finishing up, and he sent you loving kisses and said, "Oh my God, I remember him. Yes, of course." So, which is lovely, and it's obviously nice that you're listening to us from Castlemaine or whatever you call it, and you must be listening online or through the Joy app.
Through the Joy app, easily, and it's free as well.
Yep.
Now, we were talking about Prince before, and we did play Cream from him, one of his biggest hits. And we also got a message in from Melina. We love hearing from Melina. In regards to Prince, he was the soundtrack to my university life. It was a funky ride thanks to Prince. And never say rest in peace, because he is bigger than death. He was an iconoclast. And Melina mentions the quote from President Obama, "A strong spirit transcends rules." And he was such a rule breaker, and probably a rule creator as well at the same time.
Oh, absolutely. And how many other artists he helped as well. He wrote music for, and as we all know, the Bangles. Sinead O'Connor had that huge hit with Nothing Compares. Yep. So there were, and all those offshoot people that were part of his group on stage, he would then give them songs as well. Sheena Easton was another one of his people that he supported and helped through, and she performed with him, but then performed separately, and he wrote songs for her. So yeah, he was really good. And what's coming out is he never left his hometown, and he would often hire a theatre to show a movie and just invite local people to see a movie that he really wanted to see, and he didn't want to see it by himself, so he'd hire a cinema, and no one knew. You know, he would just do it with local people, and quite often it would be, "Oh, look, don't tell them it's with me. You're seeing the film." And people show up to see a free film, and he's sitting in the audience with them.
Now, you could probably give me a bit of an insight about this from my point of view, he was a very private person and had that sort of onstage persona.
Yep.
You know, the artist formerly known as Prince and Prince.
Yep. Formerly known as what happened there.
See, tell me a little
bit
about
that. He was huge.
Yes.
And he was very prolific in his songwriting, and there, by all accounts, there's thousands of songs that he's written and recorded. A lot of them are just sitting there now. And the record company didn't want to release a lot of his stuff, and he was bound to a contract there still for a while. And it was in the peak of his career, and he said, well, no, I want to do things my way. I've done justice to you guys. Yep. It's been an amazing journey. We've both made a lot of money out of it, but I want to be my own creative soul. And they went, no, we've got the binding contract. You have to do it our way. The artist Prince will do it our way. Mm. So he went, okay, I'm not going to call myself Prince anymore.
Wow.
And so that's when he became the artist formerly known as Prince. And then he was also just a sign, wasn't he? It was one of his other names that he did. And everyone thought he was just taking it a little bit too far. But when you actually think about what he did, it was really very good, because he believed, the art form that he's songwriting and he's recording. And he thought, well, no, I'm not going to be dictated to. I'm an artist. I don't want to be dictated to. So I want to do it my way or not at all. And so therefore had, those years in the woods, and then the contract ended and he went to another label and had quite success. But the funny thing is his new albums are with the original label.
Which happens sometimes.
Well, what happens is that people move on. Mm. So the management people there are well and truly gone. He's still won Grammy Awards in recent years, but he doesn't sell the volume of albums he was selling. But he still wins Grammy. I think 7 Grammy Awards he's won over the years, which is quite a few.
And he's been able to sort of balance that pop and, I guess, more sort of weighty sort of writing and sort of producing and stuff like that as well.
Yeah, well, he went very sort of heavy funk when in latter years. So he's done that. And, you know, and just the sheer fact that the concert that came here only 3 or 4 months ago, it was just him on stage with a piano, and a lot of people were singing out saying, oh, we want to hear, you know, Purple Rain and all that. And, you know, no, he wasn't going to do that. He wanted to give them some stuff that he normally wouldn't give them, and then finish with a few of the hits as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I sort of see a correlation between what he was able to do and then someone like Sia, you know, Australian singer, songwriter, producer.
Yep.
You know, she's been able to, you know, she hasn't left a label, but she's able to be known for more for the music and more for the artistic expression than for, you know, the image of Sia.
Yep. She's a painfully shy person. I saw her many years ago, it would be about 5 years ago, at Corner Hotel when she had the first round of a few hits, and she performed in a rubbish bin. She just stood in a rubbish bin with a garbage bag as a dress and just stood there and sang. And it was hysterical, really. But it was, you know, it was a lot of fun. But she wants to still, then all of a sudden she retired, had those years, and wrote for Rihanna and so many other people. But then she said, no, I still want to keep on doing my own stuff, because people become choosy about what they want to release. And obviously she is a good songwriter, because look at all the hits she's had in the last couple of years. And now wears those wigs, and it's become an art form as well.
Yes. Now we've got a message in from, well, I'm going to read the whole message. Apparently we are the Ants Pants, Davis.
Oh, are we the Ants Pants?
Wonderful show today. Donna.
Oh, thank you, Donna.
Eagle Hawk, sitting alongside Countess Sibylla Deluxe and our 3 pugs, Henry, Bonnie, and Betty.
Oh, and what a beautiful day to be out and about in Melbourne. I had to take an 8-year-old to a football match this morning at 9:30, and it was hot.
It was
sitting directly in front of the, we were facing that morning sun, and it was, everyone had to get up from the little grandstand thing and go and sit under a shady area because It was too hot to sit in the grandstand.
God, we're big complainers here, aren't we?
Yeah. But look, here's another Prince song. And do you know what I love about this one is that he wrote it, it's called 1999, mm-hmm. And he wrote it years before 1999. And 1999 came, and I remember, and I was living in Sydney, and Sydney Opera House fireworks, or Sydney Harbour Bridge, Sydney Harbour fireworks were amazing, and they did a whole segment on Prince, and they you know, because it was going into 1999, yeah. And they all of a sudden all the fireworks were purple as well.
Wow.
And it was really great, and it was wonderful to be there as I were playing that, because it would finally had come. And look how long ago 1999 was now.
Too far long ago, too much.
All right, so here's another little taste. Oh. You know, like, great songwriter, great singer, great performer. We're talking about Prince.
Joy 94.9.
You're on Joy 94.9. Of course, that was Prince himself singing about Purple Rain, which the Art Centre even had their spire this weekend, Purple, in honour of him playing there only the other week.
It's so funny.
Other month, yes.
Yeah, well, yeah, not too long ago at all.
No.
I guess fortunately that we got to, he got to have that one last trip to Australia.
Yep.
And it was such an intimate, I didn't get to go myself either, but from all reports it was very sort of intimate and very much focused on that the pureness of the music as opposed to a spectacle.
Which he normally puts on.
Yeah.
Yep. So, amazing man.
And we've got a number of messages in.
Okay.
One of them saying we were discussing his sort of fight for artistic integrity.
Yes.
So he fought for his intellectual property by putting slaves
on
his face.
Yep.
He was rebellious against the exploitation of artists by the music industry and so far ahead of his time. And he viewed women as contemporaries, thus his admiration for people like Joni Mitchell as well. Just,
And talk about songwriters. Her songwriting skills are amazing. And the woman that's coming up a little bit in our next interview might even have an opinion on Joni Mitchell. No, nothing at all.
And Melina has messaged in again saying that you articulate, how funny that I flubbed that word, how you articulate him so well.
Oh, thank you so much. And, that was very nice of you.
Their alumni had a tribute to Prince. So that's Melbourne Uni. So that's wonderful that, it has stirred something in the arts community and I guess the mainstream community as well. So it's nice to have that dichotomy and everyone sort of coming together to celebrate a legend of the music industry. So,
absolutely. So,
now it is time for our next interview. Very excited for this chat. Michaela Maguire from the Emerging Writers Festival. Welcome to Joy 94.9.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, we always delve into people's background before we get into what you're trying to talk about today, which is very important. But, tell us a little bit about your background in writing, in the arts.
So my background is as a writer. So I'll hopefully neatly lay out the progression of my career leading up until my present role. So I moved to Melbourne from Brisbane 8 years ago with a cohort of creative writing students, a few of which who were involved with The Lifted Brow, that really excellent literary magazine that you guys might know of.
Yep.
And I very luckily got offered a book deal quite soon after I moved down here with Melbourne University Press. So.
Okay. Excellent.
Yeah.
What's it called?
It was a long time ago now. Apply Within, Stories of Career Sabotage, which was sort of a kiss off to all the terrible jobs that I'd had when I was working at university.
Right. So what's it like to be a published author? Because it's tough world out there these days, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, this role with Emerging Writers Festival is the first time that I've actually had cause to file a tax return in the last 8 years. That's been nice. But
that answers the question in a way.
So, I mean, it's glamorous, but when you see cab charges charges as a form of income, it, you know, there are certain harsh realities that are associated with being an author.
Right.
How
many books?
Two and a bit. I also wrote a Penguin special, which is sort of, it's a nicely bound essay. It looks like a book, but it's only 10,000 words.
Right, okay. So in between writing, mm-hmm. what else have you done?
I worked at a law firm for quite a while as a PA, which sort of just paid the bills, but I haven't done that for quite a few years now. And in the interim, I've also been co-running and hosting a literary salon called Women of Letters that some of your listeners might have heard of.
Odd. Well, I don't think there's many people in Australia these days that doesn't know about it. There's been so much written about it, and it's crazy popular, isn't it?
Yeah, so we're 6 years in now. It's six books through Penguin Australia, and the shows still sell out within a couple of days in Melbourne, which right. is very lucky for us.
Tell people that might not know about it what it's all about.
So the basic premise is that we invite five or six women, and it's sort of usually a mix of writers, comedians, actors, politicians, cooks, like a real kind of grab bag of women. And we invite them to write a letter to a theme that they're given a month to consider. So it might be something like a letter to my former friend, or a letter to the person I misjudged, or a letter to the night I'd rather forget. And then they read them live on the stage.
It's go on, Brendan, you were going to ask something there.
Where did that seed of an idea come from to begin with?
I run Women of Letters with Marie Carty. She's my co-curator and co-founder. And we're both writers, so we sort of thought the original idea was literally just like women in a pub talking about something. We needed, you know, a kind of marketing angle and the structure for the shows. So we were emailing back and forth quite a bit, which eventually struck us as quite ridiculous because we lived a street apart. And because we were emailing so much, I think it sort of just got us thinking about letters, and Marieke in particular is a really avid letter writer. And we sort of thought both of us are quite shy and probably wouldn't agree if someone asked us to be like in a variety night at a pub or something, but we kind of could see how we would be convinced to just write a letter and read that aloud. It's very simple, the idea, and I think that's what has made it work.
With some of these letters, is it people pouring out their hearts? You know, are people,
oh yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. There's rarely a show where someone doesn't break down in tears. It happens all the time. Now, it didn't start out like that. We didn't sort of brief people like, you must come and bare your soul and cry. We want tears, goddammit. but I think it's just that personal nature of letter writing. It's a neat kind of cognitive trick that when people sit down and write, dear so-and-so, even though they're writing that letter knowing that they'll read it to 400 people, it still feels more intimate than that.
And do you find that people actually, you know, do they use computers to write these, or do they?
Oh, no.
Do
they love getting? They use computers.
But do you find that people do, you know, get out a pad and write these letters as well?
People do. Mem Fox gave us like a beautifully calligraphied copy of her letter, complete with drawings of little Australian animals around the edges. A couple of people have surprised us and written them by hand, but we kind of fully expect people to write them on their computers.
Now, you said 400 people. Mm-hmm. That's how many people are now showing up to the nights you have?
Yeah, and that's sort of packed the rafters. We can't fit any more in.
And it sells out pretty much straight away too, doesn't it?
Yeah, but there's a neat pattern that everyone has sort of clued onto. We release tickets for the new show as soon as one finishes.
So okay.
If you're just online at 5 p.m. on the last Sunday of any month, you can grab a ticket.
Why is it so popular and so important?
I think because often we have quite public-facing identities. We've had quite a few politicians do the shows over the year. Just about every well-known Australian now has done this show, except for Cate Blanchett and Julia Gillard. not that we're angry or bitter.
I'm sensing it, though.
And because the shows aren't recorded, it's really just up to the person who reads their letter whether they just want it to exist in that room for that afternoon, and plenty of them do that. So often the letters that make people cry aren't shared beyond the 400 people who are there. So it's this real intimate experience that isn't really replicated in a lot of other art forms, I think.
Would you like to see them recorded?
I mean, selfishly, I would love to see the shows in New York recorded because we run them over there monthly now, and I'm obviously living in Melbourne. But
in New York? And it's from you guys setting it up?
Yeah, it's Marieke and I and a producer and a host over there, but we still invite most of the guests and do a lot of emailing ironically. And that's been incredibly successful. And we've had women like Kathleen Turner and Molly Ringwald and Siri Hustvedt do this show. So when that's happening and I'm like at home in Melbourne at 11 a.m. in my pajamas, I do wish that it was recorded. But I also think the presence of a film crew or even a microphone that people know is recording really
would change
the mood.
Dynamic, yeah,
for sure.
And also the venue as well, I'm assuming. Do you try and keep it to a certain capacity?
Yeah, we're not going to move to the Forum or, you know, the Music
Rod
Bowl.
Laver Arena,
yeah.
Or, okay.
Yeah.
So where do you hold it? Is it the same venue every month?
Yes, we've done like kind of a shuffle on High Street. So we were at the Thornbury Theatre, then we went to the Regal Ballroom, now we're back at the Thornbury Theatre.
Right, okay. And I believe, and please tell me if I'm wrong, is that you then invite people there on the night to write a letter and send it to somebody?
Yes, that's right. So there's an intermission in the middle of the show after the participants read their letters, and we've already set out postcards and aerograms on everyone's table, and we've got a really beautiful wooden post box up the back. So we ask people to write a letter to anyone that they might have been reminded of in the afternoon, or just, you know, literally the only person whose address they remember by heart. Mm. And then we post those letters for them.
Right.
And it's part of the idea behind that as well, you know, getting people back into letter writing to begin with, because yeah. I know from my perspective, I don't write letters and haven't for years.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a nice surprise when you find a real piece of mail in the mailbox. And I think if you do take the time, and, you know, now it's the expense as well, stamps have gone up to $1, which is really messing with our charity business model. You know, if you take that time, you're probably going to write something fairly considered and, you know, usually nice and heartfelt.
So what's your feeling with Christmas cards? You know, because again, that's a dying trade as well. But I know that there's one dear friend that lives in England that I grew up with, and I see him every couple of years, and I'm a friend of his on Facebook, so we're in touch with each other. But I always get a Christmas card from him, and I never send one back.
Well, you're a bad friend.
I'm a bad friend. But then I thank him on Facebook for that. And he always puts, and then I have a friend who's a minister that I grew up with as well, and he does a beautiful Christmas card, but then his year in it.
Oh, like the Christmas newsletter.
Yeah, and that's right. I know, because I'm one of his besties, but it's really nice for a lot of his old parishioners and all that to see what he's been up to in the last 12 months. You know, like that's a nice thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I do like the Christmas newsletter. I personally don't have much sentimental value in just a standard Christmas card that says Merry Christmas on the front and my name scrawled inside.
Well, what's the point?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I went back to, because I'm originally from Adelaide, and I went back to Adelaide at Christmas, and I had lunch with cousins who I don't have a real lot to do with, and she handed me a Christmas card. And I went, why are you giving me a Christmas card when we're seeing each other? We're having this lunch.
Yeah, you're going to say Merry Christmas to each other in person.
Yeah, I don't get that. There's so much more we've got to talk to you about. You're on Joy 94.9 at Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy 94.9 in Melbourne, joy.org.au for the world.
Thank you for listening to Sunday Arts Magazine here on Joy 94.9. It's Brendan Bale with you, and I've kept around David John Hunt opposite me
as well.
And who was that, David?
That was Mr. Scott Walker. Now, talk about people who have had interesting careers as recording artists, as we were talking about with Prince. He's had a very, he was part of the Walker Brothers in the late 60s, early 70s, and then went off and had a solo career, American, and is huge in England, and then got into the whole drugs and a bit, you know, alcohol and whatever, but, prolific songwriter, and but also his interpretation of other people's music has been really, really powerful, and he's had a huge following, and there's been docos on him and everything of his really interesting career. And every 5 or so years, he becomes trendy again, and something else comes up, or he might, he doesn't really tour or anything like that anymore, but he might do a one live show and that's it. Nothing more than that. And I just think he's got an amazing voice and an amazing story as well.
It's funny you mentioned about touring though, because that seems to be, like, obviously touring's been such a strong part of the music industry for decades, you know, the whole 20th century pretty much. But, you know, for someone to be able to sort of remain relevant without touring, that's, you know, it says a lot about his artistry, because that's
absolutely,
that is how a lot of artists, well, firstly make their money, because they don't actually make it through the record companies. They make it from the touring and the merchandise and, and all that thing, all that kind of stuff. So good on him, I suppose. Now, speaking of touring, though, I noticed the lineup for Splendor in the Grass. Now, follow me here, David.
I'm with you.
Leon Bridges, is one of the names mentioned, who I know you're a big fan of.
I saw him. Was it late last year? I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, mid to late last year, I think.
Awesome. So, and I'm sure he'll come down here and do some side shows.
Well, I think he's doing a show at the Forum, at the very least.
Ah, because last year it was a small event venue, the old Billboard. So Forum, he'll be fabulous.
I think he exploded after last year. You know, everyone in Melbourne was talking about him. A lot of my friends were. And I think his support act is Nairi as well, who's a wonderful singer.
Right.
Who was, you know, got her a little bit of a start on Australian Idol, but has been very prolific.
The minute you said Australian Idol, I turned off.
I know. But, you know, everyone has to get their start somewhere.
True.
And it did give her a little bit of a push, but she's been quite prolific in touring and has sort of jumped up the rungs ever so slightly each time.
Right.
Has done a lot of supporting for bigger acts as well.
Okay.
And she's a powerhouse singer. I absolutely love her. So she's going to be supporting Leon Bridges, which is wonderful. So I really want to go. That's all I wanted to mention.
There was an amazing. Did you see the photo of him in the Age yesterday?
No.
Oh, it was with that suit that he wears and the hat.
He's
look cool.
Very dapper young man. Yep. Now, we have got off topic because we do have a visitor in the studio. We've kept her around, Michaela Maguire from the Emerging Writers Festival. Thanks for sticking around, firstly.
No problem.
And now, you are the festival director of the festival, which is quite a coup. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that came about and, you know, what you've done with the role so far?
So this role for me really feels like the natural progression of my career. I think the nice thing about the Emerging Writers Festival is that it's a festival for writers rather than for readers, which means that kind of 85% of the audience do identify as writers. But it's the type of opportunity where you can meet your new friends as well as your literary heroes in the space of a weekend. And for me, I've never forgotten the writers who sort of basically had time for me when I was just starting out and who made coffee dates with me and who looked at drafts of things that I was working on and gave me like those little bits of encouragement spaced out over, you know, the lonely year or two that it takes to write a book.
Yeah.
And that really kept me going. And I'm not sure that I would have ended up being an author without those type of writers. So I really like this idea of contributing to the community that got me here and being really involved with it.
And as you said, it's not for the reader so much. This is for the writers.
Yeah, I mean, readers do come and we love them to come along.
Of course.
But yeah, it's a festival for writers to experiment with their form, to do a performance event at a writers' festival, possibly for the first time, and to mingle with the people who are where they're going to be in 12 months or five years.
So how did you get the role?
I applied for the job and I got the job.
Right. And why do you think you were the right person for this role?
I mean, it's the first job that I've applied for where I haven't had to lie in any of the key selection criteria responses.
With the Women of Letters, I had a pretty big part in you getting the role.
It's really an extension of everything that I've been doing with Women of Letters of identifying interesting people and thinking of a conversation that would be something worthwhile and interesting and unique for them to have on stage in front of other people.
How long's the festival been going?
This is its 14th year.
Right, which is pretty big, isn't it? You know, it's a long run.
Yeah, it's changed a lot since its original inception, which I think was a zine sale out of somebody's car boot for a weekend 14 years ago. But, yeah, it's a proper festival now.
And does it help that correct me if I'm wrong, but Melbourne is the literary capital.
Yes, we're a UNESCO City of Literature.
City of Literature, that's what I was looking for. You know, does that help you in terms of sort of bringing the talent?
I mean, a lot of the talent are already here.
Well, that's true. Yeah. But in terms of sort of, assembling people and, you know, getting the cream of the crop.
Yes, I think so for sure. But there's also plenty of writers in other cities and lots of them will be joining us at the festival in June.
So tell us a little bit about how you go about, you know, connecting all the dots and the logistics behind a festival like this then.
It was really fun. I like having this much control. So
you're a control freak.
Yes. Yes. Right, I have lots of spreadsheets and a very organized calendar system. So it was really just thinking about what hasn't been done at the festival before. I didn't want to sort of just copy a template from the last couple of years. So I think I'm only keeping about two events out of 70 odd and the rest are all new, which was really fun. I had quite a few months to do it with. It's a collaborative process as well as my control freakishness. I've got a programming team that comprises of, 6 or 7 writers who are a little bit more established, who are sort of like a brains trust that I call upon every month. And we just meet over wine and talk about like what we would like to see happen. And then it's my job to think about the logistics of that and then start inviting people.
Is it just a 1 year term for you or are you?
No, I'll be there for 3 festivals.
Oh, okay. Which is good. So therefore you can develop the ones that work or didn't work next year per se.
Yeah.
Yeah. How important is this festival, for Melbourne, with the degree of everything that else is happening in this city? Yeah. You know, is it a really important festival?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, especially as a city that so much of its identity does focus around being a literary city or a city of books and writing. We're about giving professional development and encouragement and equipping the next generation of writers with the skills that they'll need to become the next, you know, literary stars of Australia.
Yeah. There's so much more to talk to you about. Like you said, we're going to run out of things. There's so many things that we're going to talk about. We'll be right back to find out more about Emerging Writers Festival. You're on Joy 94.9.
Joy.
Thanks for sticking around with us here on Joy 94.9. It is Sunday Arts Magazine, Brendan and David with you. Well, until 5 o'clock anyway. Do stick around for yesterday once more with Robin Mossy taking you through all their beautiful...
Oh, they on again, are they?
They are, and we love them. And Mossy's on the mend, thankfully. Now, we do have Michaela Maguire. We've kept you around to talk more about the Emerging Writers Festival. Now, are you kind of excited about almost the resurgence of the book in general that's happening in Melbourne and Australia and around the globe? You know, does that inspire you?
I don't know that I ever really noticed it die off.
Declining,
or decline.
Those bookshops closing though, you know, like it was quite depressing really, wasn't it?
Oh, you mean like borders and everything shutting?
Yeah.
I mean, yes, it was at the same time, but then you look at the reasons why those bookstores shut down and reasons why wonderful establishments like Readings, which just
keep on going.
The International Bookstore of the Year Award at the London Book Fair last week, you know, why that's booming and they're opening up new stores.
So do you think it is just about the quality, essentially?
There's lots of economic reasons that I'm not the best person to talk to about
this. And a lot of people are buying online and reading online as well with their Kindles. I said off air is that the one thing that I'm really noticing more and more is how many people are reading a book on public transport again, you know, years ago used to see it, where now it's back again and it's really exciting. I took a photo and put it on social media the other week and everyone says, I'm noticing the same thing. Which must be very exciting for somebody like you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I hope it's exciting for most people, but yes, especially for somebody like me who works in the,
in the biz.
Yeah.
Now tell us a little bit more about the festival. Give us a breakdown of who is your audience. You said it's the people who writers themselves.
Yeah. I mean, that's really the main demographic. It's writers, and that goes from 14 and 15 and 16 year olds through to people in their 70s. We do an open artist call out every year, and we sort of have one of our programming promises, I suppose, is that 25% of our programmed artists come from that open artist call out. So we got, I can't remember the exact figure, but it was something around about 300 or 400 people put their hand up and said, I want to be a part of the festival. This is what I would like to do. And the age range, the range of people where they lived, like every possible demographic was incredibly varied.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to pick up on. Even in our short history on radio, we've noticed the amount of people that come to the arts or to literature a lot later in life. You know, is that why you've kept that open so much? And, you know, even the name Emerging is quite a large umbrella.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of like to talk about emerging at any age.
Yeah.
And that's a message that is just being reinforced time and time again. I mean, a lot of people sort of come to writing as a second or third career. We ran the Ritual Prize for Emerging Writers in partnership with Hachette Australia last year, and there was 30 years separating the ages of the top five entrants to that, and the woman who won, Sally Abbott, is in her mid-50s, and her first book will be out, I think, at the end of this year.
So is that something that you, it sounds like you definitely encouraging with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think anyone is advocating for a world where the only books are written by 20-year-olds.
No. So what can you tell us about it? The program's not released yet.
Yes, so that is true. But I can tell you.
Ambassadors?
Yes. So the program is announced on the 10th of May, which is when it will all be revealed. But ahead of time, we've let people know about the five ambassadors. Every year there's five more established, well-known writers who are sort of the centerpiece of the National Writers Conference, which is a two-day conference of panels that this year will be held at the State Library Conference Center. And they really, as well as being on panels, they kind of just hang around for a couple of days and make themselves available to anyone who wants to bail them up for a chat or to, I don't know, get some advice. And I'm really excited about this year's ambassadors. They're excellent, wonderful people. So it's Adam Lior, who you all know and love. I don't think he needs any more description.
Yep.
Alice Pung, the award-winning author, journalist, young adult novelist, who's Melbourne-based. We've got First Dog on the Moon, the Walkley award-winning cartoonist and self-proclaimed, and I would support this, I don't know, what is the, I've just had a complete mental blank. Title? That's the word. Title. So that's First Dog on the Moon. And then we've got Shandani Lacouche, who's written something like 14 books and is an academic, and specializes in post-colonial theory. And then we've got Omar Musa, who's a poet and rapper from Queanbeyan, who was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin last year.
Oh, wow. It's quite varied.
Yes.
And that's obviously the key to it, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully there'll be something for everyone.
Yep.
Now, as well as creating the connections between artists and writers, is it also about starting conversations about what the industry is, where it's going, you know, what the art of writing is?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I hope that this year's festival will sort of talk about how do you be a writer in the world, and that'll talk about sort of practical tips about how do you combine writing with, you know, a complementary career that will actually pay the bills, or how do you make writing pay the bills, and, you know, how do you get an arts accountant, like all of that sort of really practical stuff, as well as the larger questions of what is writing for.
Yeah. And the sheer fact that these days, and it's becoming cheaper and cheaper to do it, is you self-publish.
Yeah, for sure.
Because, you know, like, and then hopefully somebody might pick it up.
Yeah.
A publisher might pick it up down the track as well.
Or, you know, there are people who are actually just making money from self-publishing because they're cutting so many of the costs.
Yes.
And they're the only person involved. So yeah, it comes straight back to them.
So when is the festival?
It is the 14th to the 24th of June.
Okay. And how do you find out more about it?
You can go to emergingwritersfestival.org.au, and all the information is there on our recently relaunched and very beautiful website.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for coming in today. It
no
was a pleasure to meet you. And we found out that the Women of Letters, you're one of the main people there as well, which is something that I've always really loved and admire that you've done that.
Thank you.
It's a very wonderful thing. You're on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
Sunday Arts Magazine here on Joy 94.9, and we love that you've stuck around, stuck it out with us until 5pm. Well, I'm Brendan.
I'm David.
And we're taking you through all the arts in Melbourne and beyond.
Beyond.
Now, we've got a message in. The track that you played before our messages was from a Malcolm McLaren and the Bootzilla Orchestra. Yep. And the lovely Donna Frock
has messaged in.
We've got another moi from her. Now you've made my day, Waltz Darling.
Thank you.
So thank you very much, Donna. And we've also got a message from the lovely Eric. Now he's saying hello, and he agrees that Melburnians, I should say, love their reading and are such bibliophiles. And he's thinking about the art book fair that's happening next week and at the NGV, which looks to be spectacular.
And we spoke about that last week.
Yes, loved our talk with Megan as well. So thank you very much, Eric, for messaging in. If you do want to do the same, make sure you email onair@joy.org.au. Now, without further ado, I should say.
Is it raining outside?
It's not, no? But it's going to be raining in here. And there might even be a little bit of singing as well. Cameron Wen, Associate Director of Singing in the Rain, thank you for coming in.
A pleasure to be here.
Now, this is a blockbuster musical coming to Melbourne.
It's a splash hit musical, they say.
Boom, boom. Oh, look, there's so many.
Oh, the marketeers have been doing their homework.
Now, you are the associate director, as I said. Tell us a little bit about your background firstly, though. We'll get to the musical. We've got plenty of time to talk about the musical. But we want to talk about you and your background.
Well, I've just come back from the UK, which is where I'm now based. Yes. But I was originally born and bred in Melbourne. Yes, I'm a Melbourne boy. And I moved to the UK 7.5 years ago because I was working on a show called Walking with Dinosaurs, the Arena Spectacular, which was an Aussie grown thing that came out of Melbourne and then went to the US, and through necessity, because we started to do a replica production, two productions, one in Europe, I had to base myself somewhere that I could jump between America and Europe, because we did it in 27 languages around the world.
Gosh.
Through Europe and Asia eventually. So I moved to the UK to facilitate that, and I've been there ever since, and that's how I ended up on Singing in the Rain in the West End.
Hold on. That's too short a history.
Okay. You want me to go back to the start?
Yeah. Back in the
I grew up in a little suburb called Eltham. I studied here and I worked here as a performer originally. So I originally...
doing what?
Musical theatre. I was originally, if you want me to go back even further, I was originally a chorister in the National Boys Choir of Australia when I was a kid. And so we did a lot of touring, a lot of singing.
That was international touring too, wasn't it?
Yes.
Right. You sang the Qantas song, and was that?
Well, that was a little bit after my time. I don't want to give away too much about my age, but yeah, that was, the National Boys Choir was half the Qantas Choir with the Australian Girls Choir, post that. But yeah, I toured when I was a little kid as Japan, and we did a tour with the Russian soloist Ivan Rebrov, and I used to sing with him. We didn't think anything of it. I remember meeting John Farnham when I was a kid and singing with him and not even realizing that every kid at school didn't kind of do that.
Oh, okay, so you weren't overwhelmed by what you were doing?
No, I think it was just what...
Kids don't probably.
No, I think that's one of the wonderful things about being in the business at that age. I mean, there are horror stories of kids that go into the business.
Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington.
That's right. And my parents are certainly not stagey types, so they were just very supportive that I wanted to do it. And then I, you know, did the usual thing, finished high school, went to uni, but at the same time was working and studying for musical theatre stuff, training. And in those days, you didn't go to a college to do that. You, took your dance classes, your singing classes, and you worked and you learnt the business.
Yep.
And did you have a bit of a knowledge or a bit of a love for the behind the scenes stuff as well as performing at that stage?
I did. I think one of the things that was great about that era was that you learnt the business in the business.
Yep.
There was no textbook and there was no course or degree for it. So I was a performer and I trained as that, and I, you know, did my work as that. And when there were jobs, I'd perform. But in between times, you know, you were unpacking the truck, driving the truck, stage managing, washing the underwear, you know, doing all the dressing and all those sorts of things that were everybody else's roles. You'd get a gig changing the gels and the lighting or that sort of thing. And I think that sets you up to understand how broad spectrum musical theatre is.
Totally. And which in a way is a bit of a dying art now, isn't it? Where so many people get there, do the course and then expect that they're going to be on stage.
Yeah, I think that the amount of training is great, because it does, flood the industry with fabulous talent and skilled talent. But there is something to be said for not coming out of a degree with 3,000 other graduates expecting that you're all going to be the one lead role.
The one lead role.
Well, there aren't that many lead roles around.
Exactly.
And I think there's a lot to be said for earning your stripes and learning the craft from the older people that are doing it with you, above you, you know.
Now, tell us, Singing in the Rain, it wasn't a musical, but of course it was on a film.
That's right.
So why? How did all this happen?
The musical actually was first done in the 80s, I believe, in the States. But prior to that, it was a 50s MGM musical movie, and obviously, that was the golden era of the MGM sort of, you know, musical movies. And it is widely known as the greatest movie musical of all time. And I think everybody has a relationship with it, which is fantastic. And it has translated very well to the stage. This production started in Chichester Festival Theatre in the UK, which is, for those of you who don't know the UK scene, a very respected regional house, headed up by artistic director Jonathan Church, who is now going into replace Cate Blanchett and Andrew Upton at Sydney Theatre Company as the artistic director there. And they do a summer season of plays and musicals, and they did a three-month season which Singing in the Rain was part of. Stage Entertainment, which is an international producing house, has offices in London, and they saw the show in Chichester, as all of London does, truck down and see all the Chichester product with a view to maybe transferring it, and they picked up Singing in the Rain and took it to the West End, and it did great guns there, starring Adam Cooper and Scarlett Strallen, and it did a recast and then a UK tour, and then of course Japan wanted it, and now we've just come back from a South African cast that's done New Zealand and Asia and South Africa, and most recently a Moscow production in Russian.
Now it's, wonderful. Now, it's one thing for, you know, a product like this, for a production like this, I should say, to be, you know, successful in its time, but what about this particularly makes it, you know, modern?
It's an interesting question, and I was talking to somebody the other day about it. I think that after great times of trouble or turmoil in society, the Great Depression, for example, or the wars, people return to entertainment and fun entertainment. Singing in the Rain is literally, as it says on the front of the theatre, I just walked past, pure joy. And it is an escapist kind of medium, I think, going to the theatre. If you look at the peaks in Broadway in terms of all the follies that they used to do and the musical theatre as well as Hollywood, you know, after the Great Depression, there was a peak. And after World War One and Two, there were peaks in entertainment of this type. Which is why I think it's had such a great resonance at the moment, because I think the world is, although we're not literally in a war or a depression, we kind of are.
Yeah.
And I think everybody just wants to spend 2.5 hours in a happy place where everything is actually, you know, fun and joyous.
And also the fact is that it's an iconic piece, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, it's, there wouldn't be many people that haven't, that don't know the song. Yeah,
that's
Singing
true.
In the Rain. And to that level, we just need, I need to do something here. And, all of a sudden it's not going to want to play games with me, but we just have to listen.
Singing in the rain, You're singing in the rain. What a glorious feel. And I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. And the sun's in my heart.
It's just, it puts a smile on your face immediately, doesn't it? Hearing that song. And as I said, you know, we all know it and know it so well.
That's one of the tricks of doing the show, though. I think one of the biggest challenges for the creative team originally was it is so well known. And how do you replicate something without, you know, in a different medium and make it comparable? Obviously, transferring it to the stage has its own logistical challenges. Raining on film is different than raining on a stage 8 times a week, particularly in the middle of a show.
Also, it rains on stage.
Well, Singing in the Rain itself, the number that the Gene Kelly character Don Lockwood sings happens just at the end of Act 1.
Right.
Obviously, because they need to dry the stage for the second act. but, yeah, I mean, it's a difficult thing. There are so many iconic moments in the show, and I think what one of the successes of this production is that it does tip the hat at the movie. You do see all those iconic moments in a different form, but it doesn't try and replicate the movie.
Mm.
And so you've enlisted the help of Adam Garcia.
Yes.
Well, very well known in Australia, but now he's UK-based and has been for a number of years. So what does he bring to the Don Lockwood role? And what were you hoping that he would bring?
Look, I think Adam's perfect for the role in the sense that if you look at the movie, Gene Kelly is Mr. Charm. I mean, we all know Adam to be that persona. He's so charming. He's an extremely talented dancer and he's known as such. And I think it's a wonderful thing that we can bring back to Australia somebody who is Australian to play this role. It's a huge responsibility to try and step into those tap shoes. And every guy that's ever played the role in the stage production has firstly been overjoyed that they've got the part, but secondly been fearful that they've got the part because they suddenly go, I've got to do Gene Kelly.
Yep.
I think Adam's up for it in spades and I think Australian audience is going to love seeing one of their own do it. And why not? Because we are so talented here.
Yeah.
And I guess it's somewhat rare to have someone that is such a great dancer and an actor and performer in the one package.
Do you know what? You're right there, Brendan, because actually people think Singing in the Rain is just a really happy show. It is an absolute nightmare to cast because it looks so effortless. But Adam dances 7 numbers in Act 1, and then he's got 15 minutes of Broadway melody in Act 2 to dance, as well as singing the songs and acting the show. And the entire ensemble basically don't leave the stage for the first hour of the show. They're either in the wings changing quickly or back on doing more stuff. So it's a real sort of triple threat show, and I think we haven't seen the likes of it in this country for a long time. There's so many shows out there at the moment, but Singing in the Rain certainly brings us back to the traditional musical theatre where everybody has to be able to do everything. And once you factor in understudies and all that sort of stuff, you know, the ensemble need to be able to play all those lead roles. So it's quite a challenge.
I just think it's so wonderful that you're bringing it. And it's opening in Melbourne. The Australian season's
Which
in Melbourne. You
great
had to.
Great for me. I love it. I'm back visiting family on the day off. And
is your mum and dad going?
They're coming on the opening night.
Oh, how sweet.
No pressure. I've got to get it right this time.
So when does it open?
We're opening on the 14th of May.
Right, okay.
At Her Majesty's Theatre.
Her Majesty's. And
we preview the week before that.
Right. We had Mark Rowe in, the general manager of the theatre in the other week. He's so excited about it coming in and we said it rains. On stage, there rains on stage.
It does rain on stage, yeah. And even in the front row.
Well, that's right. He said everyone gets a raincoat or something, a poncho or something.
People pay extra to sit in the splash zone.
Well, Cameron Wen, Associate Director of Singing in the Rain, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Shook us for opening night.
Cheers.
You're on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
It's Sunday Arts Magazine, Brendan Bowell and David Hunt with you, and it is that time of the week to say goodbye. Big thank you to Jack the Bear for coming in, as well as Michaela Maguire, the Festival Director of Emerging Writers Festival, and we also had just then Cameron Wen, Associate Director of Singing in the Rain.
Yes. So
make sure you check out all those.
Now, we're going to finish off on another Paul Kelly song. We played one at the beginning. It's part of a few people are doing for the 400th year of Shakespeare's death.
Passing, yes.
Paul Kelly has recorded seven.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.